Welcome back to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard. And when we left off with Grand Funk Railroad's Don Brewer and Mark Farner, the band had exploded with the release of their third studio album in 18 months, Closer to Home. Amidst all of the hard-earned record sales and concert ticket sales for the trio, behind the scenes, their manager and music producer, Terry Knight, had a vice grip on every aspect of Grand Funk's career, earning a notorious reputation along the way. Remember, Terry Knight was a former DJ turned band leader with Brewer and Farner as Terry Knight and the Pack, and Knight relished being the center of attention. Case in point, look on the back cover of the Closer to Home album, where Knight wrote an essay with his name in capital letters twice. Here's Grand Funk Railroad's drummer, Don Brewer.
Well, you know, we were having trouble, you know, with the, you know, the Terry Knight seems to be a running theme here. But we knew that things weren't really great with our situation with Terry. Something was wrong. We didn't know exactly what it was, and we went into the studio again in Cleveland, and Terry wanted to, you know, he wanted to kind of simulate what was going on with the Beatles, one of the Beatles records, and get that compressed sound, you know. And what he wanted to do with the compression was actually I put towels over my drums, and they made them sound compressed, but it wasn't really that electronic compression, you know. So we were playing this whole, you know, this whole different style in the studio, trying to chase after something that really I don't know, it just wasn't it just wasn't that, you know, that good. And we were, you know, we were progressing in a direction. We, you know, as a band, we were trying to find another direction to go, you know, it was kind of an experiment. It's funny, the next record we went, no, we're not doing it like that, and we came out with E Pluribus Funk, and it was like, whoa, okay, there you go. Let's get back to it the way it's supposed to be, you know, just three guys, you know, rocking in the studio, and that's, you know, that's a huge difference, you know, and there you go.
Let's go. I asked singer-guitarist Mark Farner about the challenges of playing live in a three-piece band.
You got to continually think of, you know, ways to continue the rhythmic flow without a wall of keyboards for reinforcement. It was like having to play all the time, you know, and Brewer would have to, like, keep on the cymbals to fill that space, and Mel would have to, like, overplay to enhance, you know, the low end of everything, and it was like... It was a conscious effort in design. I think we were blessed to have that continuity because Mel, if you listen, is behind the beat just a tad all the time. He played behind the beat. And Donnie was on top of the beat, and the song, the groove was laid in between them guys someplace. And that was just the natural chemistry of us three guys. And that's really what was distinctive about Grand Funk.
Once and current Grand Funk Railroad drummer Don Brewer joins me in the studio. It's funny, I've always felt that Van Halen nicked foot stomping music, particularly on the breakdown, on a song that they had on their third album called Everybody Wants Some. And I played it this morning just to make sure my memory was correct. And they did. They just rewrote your song, man.
Well, they admitted that they were, you know, a big Grand Funk, heavily influenced by Grand Funk. You know, we've talked to those guys, and they, you know, they were definitely influenced by us. And I'll never forget seeing their first album cover was David Lee Roth, you know, really doing one of his kicks, you know, but his whole image was Mark. You know, with the no shirt on, you know, on an armband, you know, on the long hair.
Never really thought of that.
That was totally Farner. It really was. You know, it was Farner's image from that, you know, and he just copped it.
That summer, 1971, your fans eclipsed a one-day record in New York City that any reasonable rock historian would have claimed to be impossible. I need to know the backstory to the demand for the Shea Stadium tickets.
Yeah, we sold out, you know, that's the, you know, one of our claims to fame. We sold out Shea Stadium faster than the Beatles. And that was that same time period, you know, right around the closer to home, you know, time period where we felt this whole thing going on out there. We were flying to Japan, you know, and having the screaming girls at the airport, you know, and we went into New York. And you know, of course, Pete Bennett was one of the promoters of that. You know, Pete's you know, little close ties to some of those other Italian guys in New York. But you know, he was one of the promoters. You know, and so he has a huge escort for us. You know, and we're like being escorted with police. You know, in our limousine through Brooklyn, through the Bronx. You know, go downtown, go down to Times Square. Here's our faces on a billboard, a block-long billboard in Times Square. And, you know, they put the tickets on sale for our show at Shea Stadium, and it sold out faster than the Beatles. It was like, you know, I forget how many hours it was, but...
was 3 days. Yeah. It sold out Shea Stadium in 3 days.
Yeah, and it was just, you know, that we knew it was this time period. We knew something was going on. I always kind of go like, well... Look at how fast places sell out now, you know, I mean, it's instantaneous, you know, so they probably got their ticket selling process together in the time between when the Beatles played there and when we played there. They just knew how to sell them better, you know, that's one of the reasons. But yeah, there was huge demand, and we were huge in New York. New York City was like one of our biggest markets, you know, we were really somebody in New York City.
In 1965, it took the Beatles 3 weeks to sell out Shea Stadium's 60,000 seats. In 1971, it took Grand Funk Railroad less than 48 hours. Mark Farner remembers the night of the show. It was July 9, 1971.
The front of the stage was at second base. Humble Pie opened the show. We flew in over Shea Stadium in a helicopter and looked down, and that place was rocking. Mm. We landed in a parking lot where the limousine was supposed to meet us. No limousine.
How does the band get to the stage?
There was a man with us that he went to the payphone, called, and three cop cars showed up there in about 5 minutes. And we rode into Shea Stadium with the lights and sirens running, and pulled up backstage, unloaded, got up there and rocked.
Our contract was definitely coming to an end. We were sitting in an office in New York City, in the attorney's office, and they were, you know, there was a lot of pressure. We had been on the road in Europe, you know, and there were, the contract was coming to an end, and there was a lot of pressure from the attorneys and from Terry for us to re-sign. And we were going, you know, something's not right. Something is not right. And they had left us alone in the office. And we started looking through, you know, the contract, and we found out that the contracts that we had signed as kids, you know, as like 18 and 19-year-olds, was giving Terry the huge lion's share of all of the royalties, you know. And we were paying taxes on the whole amount, and he was taking the vast majority of it. We were being left with like 10% that we were splitting between the three of us.
Yeah.
And we're going, why are we going to sign? We can't sign another contract with him. You know, there's no way we're going to sign it. He's ripping us off, and he's going to continue to rip us off, you know. So that, you know, we decided right there that that was it. You know, it wasn't a matter of, gee, we should wait another 90 days. It was over. We weren't going to sign another contract. And, of course, he had manipulated everything so that he owned the name. He owned this. He owned that. And we, when we walked, we said, no, well, we're gonna take the name. And we got into all these huge, you know, lawsuits, you know, and all this kind of stuff over it. He started suing every city we played in, and they, you know, and we were broke. They had all the money, you know, they had control of everything. So we had to continue to play to go on, and we started putting together new records, You know, it was a tough time period.
How did you come to work with Todd Rundgren for 73's We're an American Band? Who contacted whom first?
Well, we went after Todd. After the rock and roll soul thing and after Phoenix, we are not producers. We can't, we went into Nashville of all places to do that. Not really great rock engineers at that time in Nashville, but we wanted to be comfortable. So we went into Nashville and did it. We said, we can't do this. We need help. Not only that, FM Underground Radio, which we talked about before, which I miss dearly, still today. But FM radio had gone away. FM Underground Radio had gone away. It had become commercial. Everything had to be 2 minutes, 3 minutes long, 3 minutes and 30 seconds. You had to fit in between all of the commercial things. It had to have a hook. It had to get, it had this and that, the other thing. So we had to start writing songs. If we were going to survive this mess that we were in with Terry Knight, we had to start writing songs and producing records that would be played on this hit format, FM radio. And so we looked around for producers, and we loved what Todd Rundgren was doing. We listened to some of his records, Hello, It's Me and all these, and we loved what he was doing and what it sounded like on the radio. So we had our manager, Andy Cavallari, who was our former road manager, contact Todd's people and say, we want to hire Todd to be a producer for Grand Funk, and Todd was totally open to it. I flew up to Woodstock. He was living up in Woodstock up there, and sat down with Todd with Andy, and had a meeting of the minds and stuff, and then we flew him out to Michigan. This is Don Brewer from Grand Funk Railroad. We're an American band in the studio with Redbeard. I'd never had that difficulty because I came up in my first band, the Red Devils, and then the Jazz Masters, and I was always one of the singers, whether it be background or singing leads, you know, doing Jerry Lee Lewis or you know, Chuck Berry or a Beatles song or whatever it was. I was one of the singers, and I've always sang and played drums at the same time. I never had an issue with doing that, and I understand. Yeah, it's if you start out playing drums and you don't sing, and then all of a sudden you know somebody says, "Hey, we need you to sing." I think it's probably you know, you got your right foot doing one thing, you got your left foot doing another, you got your right hand doing another thing, and your left hand doing another, and now you got your mouth doing another syncopation as well, and you have to figure out how to breathe and take your breaths. And I would think that if you had to think about it, it'd be a bitch. But luckily I never really had to think about it. You know, it just kind of, you know, it came along with as I was learning to play. I was singing at the same time, you know, and I always used to love putting a record on and learning the parts. And while I'm learning the parts, I'm singing. You know, the critics used to smash us because, you know, Terry Knight, our manager at the time, wouldn't let us talk to the critics. You know, he wanted to do all the talking to the critics, and the critics hated that, so they took it out on the band. And I think that made the audiences and the fans love us even more. They're going, why are these guys writing all this bad stuff about my favorite band? You know, I think it turned around on them, on the critics, and made us more popular.
You can come.
two major things happen on We're an American Band. You, Don, suddenly sing about half the lead vocals, including the title song, and you're writing and you're singing Grand Funk's first number one. What gave you the green light to step up in such a dramatic fashion on We're an American Band?
Well, it was, you know, again, we go back to the Terry Knight thing, you know, it was like sink or swim time, you know, and I felt that, you know, I had some commercial ideas in my head, and I, you know, so I said, you know, I'm going to start contributing, you know, in ways that I haven't done before. And you know, we had to make this transition because we were gonna die a bad death, and Terry Knight was gonna win. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, that wasn't gonna happen. So I said, you know, I'm gonna start writing and singing, and I brought the songs into the band. You know, and again, we're rehearsing in this little rehearsal studio at the AFVM Musicians Union in Flint, which we were the only band they would let. Let rehearse there because we cleaned up after ourselves, but that's where we rehearsed all of those records there, and so we were rehearsing this record in that facility, and I remember bringing the song in. You know, I had my little Martin guitar, and I knew how to play these two chord things, you know, chord progressions, and I knew about three or four chords on the guitar. Dang, dang, dang. Okay, so I'm showing Mark, you know, these are the chords, you know, and I'm just playing these two finger things. So he's, you know, he starts playing the chords, and I said, no, power chords, you know, bam, big, huge power chords, you know. So we worked out, you know, the song, and once I played the song for the guys, you know, they were totally into working on it, and we worked up this arrangement to We're an American Band, and it was like, you know, this has got some legs. You know, it sounded pretty good. It was obvious to me a lot of the times that we'd go and play a show, and we'd read something in the paper the next day or in Rolling Stone or whatever, and the guy was saying that he was there and he didn't even have the set list right. You know, and you could tell that you know, he wasn't paying any attention to what the audience was doing. The audience was going nuts for this band, and he, you know, he's going, oh well, you know, they're just not. They're not very good musicians. They're this, they're that, you know, and it's just obvious that he wasn't even there. So it had to be something else. And the only, you know, the only thing I can think of is that they, you know, he hated Terry Knight. Terry Knight, he took out an ad one year in Billboard, I think it was, with him sitting behind the desk at Capitol Records, giving the finger to everybody. You know, that was Terry. And Terry, you know, built this whole thing. This whole image, he wanted to build this image that we were kind of like the Monkees. We were just these guys that he put together, and he tells him what to do, and he, you know, he, it's all him. He's the Svengali, and we're just his little puppets. And the critics bought it. You know, they said, oh yeah, well that's just, you know, they're just not much of a band. They're, it's all Terry, you know, and so they just, that's what the. And it wasn't like that at all, you know. I mean, we were totally on our own when we were putting together our songs, when Mark was writing his material, when we were, you know, getting ready to go on stage. Rolling Stone magazine just hated us, you know. I mean, they just hated it. We held this press conference one time, and the guy from Rolling Stone actually got up and walked out, you know. And when we fired Terry, this is right coming out around the time American Band, and we go into Madison Square Garden. All the reviews from Rolling Stone magazine for the first 3 years had been negative, negative, negative about Grand Funk Railroad. We fire Terry. We go into Madison Square Garden. Granted, we've got a couple of new songs that we're playing from the American Band album, but we're still doing really the same show we'd been doing for the two, you know, two or three times we play there before. And that all of a sudden, this guy from Rolling Stone goes, man, this band is great. and we're going, let me see. The only thing that changed really was Terry Knight's not here.
Everybody's doing a brand new dance now.
Come on, baby, do the locomotion.
I know you'll get to like it if you give it a chance now.
Come on, come on, and do the locomotion with me. You got to swing.
Hey, Don Brewer of Grand Funk Railroad here, walking like a man in the studio with Red Beard.
And I have never heard the story about how, you know, who suggested covering Carole King and Jerry Goffin's Locomotion. How did that come into the set?
There's a lot of, you know, a lot of different memories about that. I don't know what, you know, but my particular memory, I think, you know, was that, you know, we're coming off the We're an American Band album. We're coming off of We're an American Band, you know, top number one hit. Walk Like a Man was a, you know, top 20 hit or maybe even top 10 hit. I forget what it was. Yeah, the album was a huge, you know, huge success. You know, we still hadn't settled our dispute with Terry Knight, but we felt we were winning, you know, and we had gone into the studio for the second time with Todd to work on our next record, Shining On. And, you know, things weren't quite as good as they were before, you know, with stuff in the studio with Todd. And, you know, I we were having some difficulty coming up with more songs. And we had finished Shining On, you know, which was going to be the single. And we finished, you know, the rest of the record, you know, and it was a good record, but it certainly wasn't quite up to the level of We're an American Band. And we took a break one day at the studio at the Swamp. We need another song. And Mark came back from dinner and walked in to the studio, and he's going, "Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on." And we went nuts. We were going, how stupid is that?
Did the band just fall in?
We jumped in on it, you know, and Todd, you know, loved the idea, and we just went, it's got to be such an idiotic idea. Maybe it'll work, you know, so... let's Grand Funk Railroad doing the Locomotion, you know? So Todd said, yeah, let's, you know, he wanted to create this image, kind of like what the Beach Boys had with Barbara Ann. It sounded like a big party going on
exactly.
In the studio, you know?
Exactly.
And that's what we did with Locomotion. We went out in the studio and just, you know, we called Andy, our manager, and said, we got to have the lyrics for Locomotion, Carole King's Locomotion, because we're going to do it. And so we put together this track, and it was just a killer track. Todd worked all of his magic on the dials, came up with some great keyboard stuff that we had Craig Frost working with us. But Craig is more of a clavinet, Hammond B3 guy, and Todd was this synthesizer guy. You know, he knew how to do all the patches. You know, to make a Moog sound like a, you know, outrageous. So he came up with all these sounds. And again, we're creating this thing to this sound that Todd is creating, you know. So, you know, it's like all of us creating this big party going on in the studio.
Okay.
Give me some examples of how Todd Rundgren coaxed Grand Funk to up their studio game.
We were talking earlier about Grand Funk and Closer to Home being a progression from On Time as far as confidence. You know, Todd, I think, brought confidence to our playing in that when you're in all of these records we did in Cleveland, they were really bare. Other than for the production on Closer to Home and a couple other things where we added the orchestras and stuff, the production was pretty bare. And, Todd was totally into not recording flat, everything. He was into recording with the echo, with the EQ, all of that stuff. So when you're in the studio working with Todd, you're listening in your headphones to exactly what it's going to sound like when he's done mixing everything, and that sound to me, especially on the drums, is like, man, it freed me up to be able to play a whole new level. And I think it freed up the other guys in the band to play a whole new level, because what you're hearing isn't just flat and dry with no echo on it. It's got this great sound to it. And when you're playing to that sound, it's the difference of playing in a nightclub to playing in an arena. And it's like, wow, so I think that confidence really showed. And having Todd sitting behind the board, a lot of people complained about him, because he was so aloof, and kind of withdrawn, but he'd sit in there and have his feet up on the board, and we were out there rehearsing the songs and stuff. And we'd say, okay, Todd, we're ready to do it, and he'd put his book down and he'd hit play, record on the machine, and away we'd go, And it sounded so good, It was like, wow, listen to the way that sounds, So you play to the way that sounds. And I think that's what that upped our game.
I'm in love with the girl that I'm talking about. I'm in love with the girl I can't live without. I'm in love, but I sure picked a bad time to be in love, to be in love. Well, let her be somebody else's queen. I don't wanna know about it. There's too many others that know what I mean, and that's why I got to live without it. I'm in love with the girl I'm talking about. I'm in love with the girl I can't live without. I'm in love, but I feel like I'm wearing it out. I'm in love, but I must have picked a bad time to be in love. 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 All the stories coming back to me from my friends and the people.
Was everybody on board for this? Any skeptics or resistance?
Well, at that time, everybody was totally into it. You know, at the time we were doing We're an American Band, you know, totally everybody was into it. You know, the animosity, I think, that came about later between Mark and Todd was, you know, when we were working on this Shining On record, you know, and there was some, I think there was some guitar player envy going on back and forth between one and the other. I don't know what was going on. But that's when that kind of, you know, was going down the tubes. But during the We're an American Band record, everybody was totally into having Todd there. We flew down to Miami. We went into Criteria Studios, which was the hit studio going on, a lot of hit stuff going on down there. You know, so we, you know, that was fun to be in Miami working at that studio for that record and having the Capitol people there, you know, anticipating a hit record. You know, it was exciting.
King cover for Grand Funk Railroad with Some Kind of Wonderful. This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guests Don Brewer and Mark Farner. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, @RedbeardRocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.